Job 7. There was a knock on the door. Dressed in a pair of plaid Bermuda shorts and a Brooklyn Dodgers t-shirt, Job padded across the basement and peered through the spy hole. Dr. Tachyon stood on the stoop, wearing a white summer suit with wide notched lapels over a Kelly green shirt. His orange ascot matched the silk handkerchief in his pocket and the foot-long feather in his white fedora. He was holding a bowling ball. Job pulled back the police bolt, undid the chain, lifted the hook from the eye, turned the key in the deadlock, and popped the button in the middle of the doorknob. The door swung open. Dr. Tachyon stepped jauntily into the apartment, flipping the bowling ball from hand to hand, then he bowled it across the living room floor. It came to rest against the leg of the Tachyon transmitter. Tachyon jumped in the air and clicked the heels of his boots together. Job shut the door, pressed the button, turned the key, dropped the hook, latched the chain, and slid shut the police bolt before turning. The red-haired man swept off his hat and bowed. "Dr. Tachyon, at your service," he said. Job made a gurgling sound of dismay.
"Tachyon princes are never at anyone's service," he said. "And white isn't his color. Too, colorless. Did you have any trouble?"
The man sat down on the couch.
"It's freezing in here," he complained. "And what's that smell? You're not trying to save that body I got you, are you?"
"No," said Job. "Just a little meat that went bad."
The man's outlines began to waver and blur. In the blink of an eye, he'd grown 8 inches and gained 50 pounds. The red hair had turned long and gray, the lilac eyes had gone black, and a scraggly beard had sprouted from a square-cut jaw. He locked his hands around his knee.
"No trouble at all,"
he reported, in a voice much deeper than Tachyon's.
"I came in looking like a spider with a human head, and told them I had athlete's feet, 8 of them. Nobody but Tachyon would touch a case like that, so they stuck me behind a curtain and went for him. I turned into Big Nurse and ducked into the ladies' room down from his lab. When they paged him, he went south and I went north, wearing his face. If anyone was looking at the security monitors, they saw Dr. Tachyon entering his lab, that's all."
He held his hands up appraisingly, turning them up and down.
"It was the strangest feeling. I mean, I could see my hands as I walked. Swollen knuckles, hair on the back of my fingers, dirty nails. Obviously there wasn't any kind of physical transformation involved. But whenever I passed a mirror, I saw whoever I was supposed to be, just like everyone else."
He shrugged. The bowling ball was behind a glass partition. He'd been examining it with scanners, Waldo's x-rays, stuff like that. I tucked it under my arm and strolled out.
"They let you just walk out?"
Job couldn't believe it.
"Well, not precisely. I thought I was home free when Troll walked past and said good afternoon as nice as you please. I even pinched a nurse and acted guilty about stuff that wasn't my fault, which I figured would cinch things for sure."
He cleared his throat.
"Then the elevator hit the first floor, and as I was getting off, the real Tachyon got on. Gave me quite a start."
Job scratched at a tusk.
"What did you do?"
Freud shrugged.
"What could I do? He was right in front of me, and my power didn't fool him for an instant. I turned into Teddy Roosevelt, hoping that might throw him, and devoutly wished to be somewhere else. All of a sudden, I was."
"Where?"
Job wasn't sure he really wanted to know.
"My old school," Freud said sheepishly. "Ninth grade algebra class. The same desk I was sitting at when Jet Boy blew up over Manhattan in 46. I have to say, I don't remember any of the girls looking like that when I was in ninth grade."
He sounded a little sad.
"I would have stayed for the lecture, but it caused quite a commotion when Teddy Roosevelt suddenly appeared in class clutching a bowling ball. So I left, and here I am. Don't worry, I changed subways twice and bodies 4 times.
He got to his feet, stretched.
"Oh, Walrus, I have got to give it to you. It's never dull working for you."
"I don't exactly pay minimum wage either,"
Job said.
"There is that," Freud admitted. "And now that you mention it, have you ever met Veronica, one of Fortunato's ladies? I had a notion to take her to Aces High and see if I could talk Hiram into serving his rack of lamb."
Job had the stones in his pocket. He counted them out into the sleeper's hand.
"You know,"
Job said when Croyd's fingers closed over his wages,
You could have kept the device for yourself. Maybe gotten a lot more from someone else.
This is plenty, Freud said. Besides, I don't bowl. Never learned to keep score. I think they do it with algebra.
His outline shimmered briefly, and suddenly Jimmy Cagney was standing there, dressed in a snappy light blue suit with a flower in his lapel. As he climbed the steps to the street, he began to whistle the theme song to an old musical called Never Steal Anything Small. Jube shut the door, pressed the button, turned the key, dropped the hook, and latched the chain. As he slid the police bolt shut, he heard a soft footstep behind him and turned. Red was shivering in a green and yellow Hawaiian shirt filched from Jube's closet. He'd lost all of his own clothing in the raid on the cloisters. The shirt was so big he looked like a deflated balloon.
"That the gizmo?" he asked.
"Yeah,"
Jube replied. He crossed the room and lifted the black sphere with careful reverence. It was warm to the touch. Jube had watched the televised press conference when Dr. Tachyon returned from space to announce that the Swarm Mother was no longer a threat. Tachyon spoke eloquently and at length about his young colleague Mai and her great sacrifice, her courage within the Mother, her selfless humanity. Jube found himself more interested by what the Takesian left unsaid. He downplayed his own role in the affair and made no mention of how Mai had gotten inside the Swarm Mother to effect the merging he spoke of so movingly. The reporters seemed to assume that Tachyon had simply flown Baby to the Mother and docked. Jube knew better. When the sleeper woke, he had decided to play his hunch.
"Hate to tell you, but it looks like a bowling ball to me," Red said amiably.
"With this, I could send the complete works of Shakespeare to the galaxy you call Andromeda,"
Jube told him.
"Palamine," said Red. "They'd only send it back. And tell you it wasn't suitable to their current needs."
He was in much better shape now than when he'd first turned up on Jube's doorstep 3 weeks after the Aces had smashed the new temple, wearing a hideous moth-eaten poncho, work gloves, a full-face ski mask, and mirror shades. Jube hadn't recognized him until he'd lifted his shades to show the red skin around his eyes.
"Help me,"
he'd said, and then he'd collapsed. Jube had dragged him inside and locked the door. Red had been gaunt and feverish. After fleeing the cloisters, Jube had missed the whole thing, for which he was profoundly grateful. Red had put Kim Toy on a greyhound to San Francisco, where she had old friends in Chinatown who would hide her. But there was no question of his going with her. His skin made him too conspicuous. Only in Jokertown could he hope to find anonymity. He'd run out of money after 10 days on the street and had been eating out of the trash cans behind Harry's ever since. With Roman under arrest and Matthias dead, freeze-dried by some new ace whose name had been carefully kept from the press, the rest of the inner circle were the objects of a citywide manhunt. Jube might have turned him in. Instead, he fed him, cleaned him up, nursed him back to health. Doubts and misgivings gnawed at him. Some of what he had learned about the Masons appalled him, and the greater secrets they hinted at were far, far worse. Perhaps he should call the police. Captain Black had been aghast at the involvement of one of his own men in the conspiracy, and had publicly sworn to nail every Mason in Jokertown. If Red was found here, it would go badly for Jube. But Jube remembered the night that he and 12 others had been initiated at the cloisters, remembered the ceremony, the masks of hawk and jackal, and the cold brightness of Lord Amun as he towered over them, austere and terrible. He remembered the sound of Tiamat as the initiate spoke the word for the first time, and remembered the tale the worshipful master told them of the sacred origins of the order, of Giuseppe Bosalmo, called Cagliostro, and the secret entrusted him by the Shining Brother in an English wood. No more secrets had been forthcoming on that night of nights. Jube was only a first-degree initiate, and the higher truths were reserved for the inner circle. Yet it had been enough. His suspicions had been confirmed, and when Red, in his delirium, had stared across Jube's living room and cried out, "Shakti!" he had known for a certainty. He could not abandon the Mason to the fate he deserved. Parents did not abandon children, no matter how depraved and corrupt they might grow with the passage of years. Twisted and confused and ignorant the children might be, but they remained blood of your blood, the tree grown from your seed. The teacher did not abandon the pupil, There was no one else. The responsibility was his.
"We're gonna stand here all day?"
Red asked as the singularity shifter tingled against the palms of Jube's hands.
"Or are we gonna see if it works?"
"Pardon," Jube said, lifting a curved panel on the tachyon transmitter.
He slid the shifter into the matrix field. He began the feed from his fusion cell and watched as the power flux enveloped the shifter. St. Elmo's fire ran up and down the strange geometries of the machine. Readout swam across shining metal surfaces in a spiky script that Jube had half forgotten and vanished into angles that seemed to bend the wrong way. Red lapsed back into Irish Catholicism and made the sign of the cross.
"Jesus, Mary, and Joseph," he said.
"It works," Jubin thought.
He should have been triumphant. Instead, he felt weak and confused.
"I need a drink," Red said.
"There's a bottle of dark rum under the sink."
Red found the bottle and filled two tumblers with rum and crushed ice. He drank his down straight away. Jube sat on the couch, glass in hand, and stared at the tachyon transmitter, its high, thin sound barely audible above the air conditioner.
"Walrus," Red said when he had refilled his tumbler. "I had you figured for a lunatic, an amiable lunatic, sure, and I'm grateful to you for taking me in and all, with the police after me the way they are. But when I saw you'd built your own Shakti machine, well, could blame me for thinking you're a little short on the gray matter."
He downed a slug of rum.
"Ah, yours is four times as big as Kafka's," he said. "Looks like a bad model, but I never saw the roaches light up that way."
"It's larger than it needs to be because I built it with primitive electronics,"
Jube told him. He spread his hands, three thick fingers and blunt curved thumb.
"And these hands are incapable of delicate work. The device at the cloisters would have lit up had it ever been powered."
He looked at Red.
"How did the worshipful master plan to accomplish that?"
Red shook his head.
"I can't tell you. Sure, and you're a prince to save me sweet red arse, but you're still a first-degree prince, if you get my meaning."
"Could a first-degree initiate construct a Shakti machine?"
Jube asked him.
"How many degrees had you passed before they even told you the device existed?"
He shook his head.
"Well, never mind. I know the punchline. How many jokers does it take to turn on a light bulb? One, as long as his nose is AC." The astronomer was going to power the machine himself.
The look on Red's face was all the confirmation Jube needed.
"Kafka's Shakti was supposed to give the Ardor dominion over the Earth," the Mason said.
"Yeah,"
Jube said. The Shining Brother in the Wood gave the secret to Cagliostro and told him to keep it safe, to hand it down from generation to generation until the coming of the Dark Sister. Probably the Shining Brother had given Cagliostro other artifacts. Without a doubt, he had given him a power source, there being no way the Takesian wild card could have been anticipated 2 centuries ago.
"Clever," Jube said aloud.
"Yeah, but still a man of his times. Primitive, superstitious, greedy. He used the things he had been given for selfish personal gain."
Who?"
Red asked, confused.
"Balsamo,"
Jube replied. Balsamo had invented the rest himself, the Egyptian mythos, the degrees, the rituals. He took the things he had been told and twisted them to his own use.
"The Shining Brother was a Libar,"
he announced.
"What?"
Red said.
"A Libar," Jube told him. "They're cyborgs, Red. More machine than flesh. Awesomely powerful. The jokers of space. No two look alike. But you wouldn't want to meet one in the alley. Some of my best friends are Libar."
He was babbling, he realized, but he was helpless to stop.
"Oh, yeah. It could have been some other species. Maybe a Kreg, or even one of my people in a liquid metal spacesuit. But I think it was a Libar. You know why? Tiamat."
Red just stared at him.
"Tiamat,"
Jubin repeated. The newsboy gone from his voice and manner, speaking as a network scientist might speak.
"An Assyrian deity. I looked that up. Yet why call the Dark Sister by that name?
Why not Baal, or Dagon, or one of the other nightmarish godlings you humans have invented? Why is the ultimate power word Assyrian when the rest of the mythology Cagliostro chose was Egyptian?
I don't know, Red said.
I do. Because Tiamat sounds vaguely like something the Shining Brother said. Fiat Mehur, darkness for the race, the Libar term for the swarm.
Jube laughed. He had been telling jokes for 30-odd years, but no one had ever heard his real laugh before. It sounded like the bark of a seal.
The master trader would never have given you world dominion. We don't give anything away for free. But we would have sold it to you. You would have been an elite of high priests, with gods who actually listened and produced miracles on demand.
You're crazy, Palamine, Red said with forced jocularity. The Shakti device was going to...
Shakti just means power, Jubin said. It's a tachyon transmitter, and that's all it ever was.
He rose from the couch and thumped over to stand by the machine.
Zetek saw it and spared me. He thought I was a stray, a leftover from some offshoot branch. Probably he felt it would be wise to keep me around in case anything happened to Kafka. He'd be here now, but when Tiamat headed back toward the stars, the Shakti device must have seemed somewhat irrelevant.
Sure, and it isn't?
No, the transmitter has been calibrated. If I send the call, it'll be heard on the nearest network outpost in a matter of weeks. A few months later, the opportunity will come.
Ah, what opportunity is that, brother? Red asked.
The Shining Brother will come, Jubin told him. His chariot is the size of Manhattan Island, and armies of angels and demons and gods fight at his beck and call. They'd better. They've got binding contracts, all of them.
Red's eyes narrowed in a squint.
You're telling me it's not over, he said. It can still happen, even without the Dark Sister.
It could, but it won't,
Jube said.
Why not?
I don't intend to send the call.
He wanted to make Red understand.
I thought we were the cavalry. The Tarkesians used your race as experimental animals. I thought we were better than that. We're not. Don't you see, Red? We knew she was coming. But there would have been no profit if she never arrived, and the network gives nothing away for free.
I think I'm getting it, Red said.
He picked up the bottle, but the rum was gone.
I need another drink, he said. How about you?
No,
Jube said. Red went into the kitchen. Jube heard him opening and closing drawers. When he came out, he had a large carving knife in his hands.
Send the message, he said.
I went to see the Dodgers once,
Jube told him. He was tired and disappointed.
Three strikes and you're out at the old ball game. Isn't that what they say? The Tarkesians, my own culture, and now humanity. Is there anyone who cares for anything beyond themselves?
I'm not kidding, Walrus. Red said. Don't want to do this, pal of mine, but us Irish are a stubborn bunch of cusses. Eh? The cops are hunting us down out there. What kind of life is that for me and Kim Toy, I ask you? If it's a choice between eating out of garbage cans and ruling the world, I'll take the world every time.
He waved the carving knife.
Send a message. Then I'll put this away and we can order up a pizza and swap a few jokes, okay? You can have rotten meat on your half.
Jube reached under his shirt and produced a pistol. It was a deep, translucent red-black, its lines smooth and sensual, yet somehow disquieting, its barrel pencil-thin. Points of light flickered deep inside it, and it fit Jube's hand perfectly.
Stop it, Red, he said. It won't be you ruling the world. It'll be the astronomer and demise, or guys just like them. They're bastards! You told me so yourself!
We're all bastards, Red told him. And the Irish aren't as thick as they say. That's a toy ray gun, pal of mine.
I gave it to the boy upstairs for Christmas, Jube said. His guardian gave it back. It wouldn't break, you see, but the metal was so hard that Doughboy was breaking everything else in the house when he played with it. I put the power cell back in and wore the harness whenever I went to the cloisters. It made me feel a little braver.
I don't want to do this, Red said.
Neither do I,
Jubin replied. Red took a step forward. The phone rang a long time. Finally, someone picked it up at the other end.
Hello?
Freud, Jube said. Sorry to bother you. It's about this body.